This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks with our weekly news review. A Cincinnati school board member was caught on video roasting local parents, and now she's asking for grace. WVXU reporter Corey Sharber joins us now via Zoom. Corey, thanks for being with us.
No problem, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Corey, who are we talking about?
Talking about board member Melanie Bates today.
And Melanie Bates has been on the school board for a while. She says that these comments that we're about to discuss arose from a secretly recorded video. Tell us about that. Where was it? Who did it?
Right. So that's the thing. We don't know the identity of the people who have recorded it yet, but it made the rounds, I believe, in a Reddit post before it was taken down. And the private conversation she had was at a pub in St. Bernard. And during the conversation, apparently she said she was venting during the incident. She said she's sick and tired of these Wanna Hills people. And then when she was talking about teachers, she allegedly said, suck it up and go back to work, and then said another sentence that's not approved for a radio-friendly audience. So you'll have to read the article to get that.
You can. You'll find that she said they're a bunch of expletive whiners making $70,000 to $80,000 a year. Why Walnut Hills? We've had you on to talk about this before. Why was she upset with Walnut Hills?
Well, with Walnut Hills, as we all know, the school's overcrowded, and because we're in a pandemic, the classrooms just aren't able to hold enough students for social distancing. The board has been going back and forth whether or not to have students in school with 3 feet of social distancing. They also had a plan to keep them at 6 feet, but it would have only allowed for 9 students per classroom. And of course, then the board reneged on that decision and voted 5-2 to keep Walnut Hills remote for the near future.
And that's different than the rest of the district?
That's correct. Every other school is in at 6 feet of social distancing.
And so that has upset some families connected to Walnut Hills High School. And that's apparently what provoked board member Bates to say this.
I would assume so. I mean, I've spoken with parents about this issue, and they want their kids in 5 days a week, but you mean, let's face it, the pandemic, I mean, you can't just go willy-nilly with this. It's a serious situation. So right now, the best a board can offer is to keep them keep them remote.
So Melanie Bates was not only talking about Walnut Hills parents during this secretly recorded conversation where she was at a pub in, I think you said, St. Bernard. She was also talking about another member of the school board, right?
Right. I don't know the exact comments she said about Board Vice President Ryan Messer, but she did express disappointment in him deciding to keep voting to keep Walnut Hills remote. Melanie Bates and Eve Bolden were the only two no votes in that decision.
So they were in favor of reopening the school?
Right.
So interesting. So what is out there now with her words? What is she saying now that she's been caught on video saying this stuff?
Well, of course, she has since apologized for the alleged remarks. And of course, the video, she's also saying that it was, she's apparently seeking like some sort of legal action with it because, again, it was a recording of a private conversation she was having with other people. So the legal ramifications in that situation, it's still a little fuzzy. We're not sure where they're at on that situation.
Some people are calling for her resignation. Any indication that she will oblige?
Well, according to an Inquirer article, she has said she will not resign. But of course, multiple people during the board meeting during which she apologized and asked for grace were calling for her resignation. Many people, of course, all over the internet are voicing that same message.
Corey Sharber is a reporter here at WVXU, primarily covering the Cincinnati Board of Education in addition to other local areas of interest. You can follow him at WVXU.org. Corey, thanks for the time you gave us. Have a great weekend.
You too, Michael. Thank you very much.
And from the Cincinnati Board of Education to Cincinnati City Hall now, joining us our Inquirer reporter, Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. And we're also joined by WVXU reporter Becca Costello, both joining via Zoom. Becca, thanks for coming in.
No problem. Thanks, Michael.
And thanks for handling the phones on your first WVXU fund drive this morning. We appreciate that as well.
Yeah, happy to everyone who supports us.
Absolutely. So we are bringing both of you on together to talk about this piece of, well, this would be something that the voters would consider related to expanding access to affordable housing, $50 million every year dedicated to that. Becca, we're hearing elected officials and some candidates for office in the upcoming elections this year opposing the idea. Again, it's not a piece of legislation, though, right? I mean, this would be a charter amendment that would be up to the voters.
That's right. And it is likely to be on the ballot in May. Now, those signatures for the petition to get it on the ballot haven't been certified yet. That'll happen with the Board of Elections next week. But it seems like they have enough signatures to get on the ballot, and it will be up to voters. And one of the criticisms, actually, from a couple of city council members is that they feel like the language is not easy to understand. It'll be just a short paragraph that will actually appear on the ballot. And yet the entire proposal is almost 3 pages long. So there's a lot of detail in there that voters won't see on the actual ballot. And that was one of the criticisms that we've heard so far.
So basically, some of the criticism is that, sure, $50 million each year devoted to making housing more affordable sounds nice, but there's a lot of fine print. What would that fine print do? What would this do, Becca?
Well, the biggest thing we're hearing is that Mayor Cranley and city officials or city council members are saying this would basically decimate the budget, that there are just public services that we would not be able to continue to do if we dedicated $50 million a year to housing. And the biggest thing being that, you know, the amendment doesn't identify any new sources of funding. So this would most likely come out of the money that the city is already putting forward. And that would necessarily mean that something else has to stop. What we're hearing is warnings that there would be hundreds, of, if not thousands, of layoffs among police and fire and sanitation and other basic services. And so a lot of council members saying, you know, we need to provide our basic services. And this charter amendment would mean that we have to make severe cuts.
Sherry, who's behind this?
You know what? There's three. Josh Spring is really kind of driving it. This is the he's the Homeless Coalition. He's like the president of that group. But here's the deal with this. Josh Spring has asked for this for years. We're talking like 5 years at City Hall. We need an affordable housing trust fund. These things are very important to cities, especially cities like Cincinnati that has old housing stock and has an affordable housing crisis. There is no getting around that. Josh Spring came to David Mann in 2018 and is like, let's do this. And David Mann said, okay, we'll create one. They literally created one with hardly any money and no real funding stream for this. And he said at the time, don't worry, we'll find one. It's 2021, it is an election year, and there's no real funding for this. And Josh Spring and these other groups, whose names are escaping me at the moment, said, okay, then we'll do it ourselves. And so they put forward this $50 million a year requirement charter amendment. Now, it actually limits the kind of money that can be used on this. It spells out the money can come from this, the money can come from that, the money can come from the other thing. Okay, there's like about 9 things. Now, there are outside funding streams in it, but they're ones that are not that palatable, like taxing some things. And there's another one that's like make the developers pay for it themselves. City Hall's not going to do that. So then the other things become like the operating fund, railway money that goes into the capital fund. So it really does become what Becca was talking about. The realistic look, if this passes, is that it's going to really impact the current ongoing budget, whether it's on the operating side or the capital side. If you think about what the operating budget is, $400 million a year, roughly. This is $50 million a year that would go into this fund.
Becca, we just heard Sherry reference Councilman David Mann. He's running for mayor, and he, according to your reporting, is asking for a couple of things, like an opinion from the city solicitor, basically checking into the legality and the enforceability of this proposed charter amendment. And he also wants a report from the city manager related to the proposal and the city's ability to even continue current basic and essential services. Do we have any indication on when such reports might be understood? We've got a primary election coming up soon when this would be on the ballot.
Yeah, well, that sort of official report, David Mann asking, has filed this motion. It has to go to committee first, and that committee is not meeting until that first week of March. And then once it passes committee, it'll go back to full council. So it'll be a little while before they file that report. But these are questions that the city administration would be looking into anyway. These are kinds of questions that they're already getting from council members and even from the public, people saying like, whoa, 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 this seems like a big deal. Would this work? How would it be feasible? So as early as Tuesday, I know we're going to hear at least a couple of these issues addressed. There is a relatively new subcommittee on affordable housing, and they're meeting for the second time on Tuesday. And they are planning to hear from, I believe, the city solicitor and maybe a couple other folks from city administration to address some of these questions, at least initially. Now, in terms of, we're hearing a lot about threats of layoffs, like if this happened, there'd be layoffs and lots of layoffs. Things about those specific numbers, I think it'll be a little bit longer before we know those details. Like Sherry said, there's a lot of potential sources of funding for this. So what I'm hoping to see from the administration is them kind of laying out, well, if we paid for it this way, this is what would happen versus some other options. So hopefully some information soon, but the full scope, I think it's going to be a couple weeks at least before we know those details.
Becca Costello is a reporter at WVXU, primarily covering local government. Follow her reporting here on 91.7 and at WVXU.org. Becca, thank you so much for spending a little bit of your Friday with us. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, Michael.
Sherry Coolidge from The Inquirer is staying with us. We're going to talk about the changes on the ballot lineup in the Cincinnati mayoral race in just a moment. But I want to ask one more question about the affordable housing issue as it relates to the politics of it. And Sherry, it seems affordable housing is a common campaign plank for many candidates. But we're mostly seeing local leaders and candidates in this year's municipal races opposing this measure. What can you tell us about that?
You know, I mean, Becca was talking about this memo. You can expect the city administration to say this is a terrible thing, like everyone can kind of predict here. That won't be the surprise. The real thing is this ballot language is all sunshine and roses. Like voters will see, you know, affordable housing to help the crisis kind of thing. And that does seem like a good thing. And so that's why a lot of people are concerned and weighing in. David Mann obviously is not for, he's like, we need this something, but this isn't it. And he put out a call to mayoral candidates, and it's like, he's like trying to put everybody on the record. And so what they think about it, like these three like known names agreed with him. I mean, Cecil Thomas himself and Aftab Pirabel, they are on the record as saying this isn't the solution. But we saw Gavi Begtrup, one of the candidates, he said, you know what? He's tired of the talk and, you know, this isn't perfect, but let's do it. We have to do something. And so that's kind of where we heard from these people. Expect, you know, this is going to be a main issue in the mayoral primary race, which the real question to these people is, if this isn't it, fine. What is it? The citizens of Cincinnati, they want to know what the solution for affordable housing is. So this is really starting like a huge conversation. And this will be, I think, the number one topic in this mayoral primary race.
Well, speaking of the mayoral primary race, we had our good friend Chris Wederick from the Business Courier on last Friday to talk about which candidate ultimately filed and submitted their signatures. But in that week since, it's changed again because a couple of, you know, known names around here as it relates to electoral politics did not have enough valid signatures. Tell us how different the field looks today.
You know, I think the biggest thing, three people did not make the ballot. Wendell Young didn't have enough signatures. Community activist Kelly Prather and, you know, Dot Loop founder Adam Kaler. Both Adam and Kelly are, you know, they're challenging some of this. They say they have more signatures than the Board of Elections thought. We're going to see on Tuesday during certification day if they actually do make the ballot. But Wendell Young was the real news there because he was really, he's a council person, 10 years, a former police officer, MSD. I mean, he's a known person to Cincinnati, and he was going to be part of like this known field of candidates. And his not making the ballot really benefits Cecil Thomas because they were going to split some of like, you know, their supporter base. And so it'll be that is not just Wendell's not on the ballot. It kind of like threw into, you know, into the air, like, well, then really who's going to make this top two that go into the general election?
Yeah, because it is a relatively large field when you think to recent mayoral elections since Cincinnati went to this form of electoral politics for mayoral races, a pretty big field with about half of the candidates pretty well known and elected to office before. And this really does change things. What was Councilman Young's explanation for not being able to fulfill this very basic requirement to appear on a ballot? He's done it before.
You know, I think that he didn't really say what the exact problem was. I think, you know, he had some were going to be disqualified. He was always thought he was going to be close. I talked to him Wednesday night, the night before the filing deadline, and he's like, we're still getting signatures. He turned in 800 some, you need 500. So, but he wasn't going to make it even with these outside circulators or signatures got thrown out because you need to be inside the city to actually circulate petitions. Like these nuances all matter. Like I've learned like 10 new nuances this election. But so he thought he didn't realize that. And then it was close anyway. But, you know, it's the pandemic. It's cold. Wendell Young suffered a very, very serious heart attack in 2018. And he's being COVID safe. And you see that in City Hall on a weekly basis, like when he comes, when he doesn't. And I think that like that hindered him. And I actually think it is hindering some people I had heard were going to run for council. And are like not willing to put themselves out there now to get those kind of signatures during a pandemic, which we are still in.
So you noted that Young's departure from the race is likely departure after certification on Tuesday benefits State Senator Cecil Thomas, who was also on city council before. What does this do to the rest of the race? I mean, do we see a top tier emerging, a mid tier, a lower tier among the remaining candidates?
There's no question about it. There's a top tier because they're just known people like Aftab Purival. People are like, he's the one to beat. People are just City Hall insiders. Just people know him. When you run a race against Shabbat, no matter that you lose that race, it the name ID that you get from that, it cannot be beat because it's just huge over all of these areas of the city. So he's the one that it's like, who else is going to get in these top two? But, you know, I think the one thing, if you're every other year, you're like the two known people get through. But people are very upset with City Hall. Very. These three arrests of the city council members, people are sick of it. And you hear that a lot. And I just wonder, like, how much that's going to set up, like, an outsider. Let's say, you know, Gavi Begtrup. I mean, he said, I'm running, and I didn't know Gavi before that. And I was like, okay, I'd like to write about you, you know, let me know. He's like, the next day, he's like, okay, I have the signatures. I was like, I didn't think you were met in 12 hours, but okay. And he's knocking on doors. And I just wonder how much like this is going to be outsider versus insider. And citizens might be like, it's time for a change.
Well, what do you think the campaign will look like? What should we expect in the politics of it? I imagine that these folks in Cincinnati on the ballot for mayor, they're not that far apart ideologically. If you were to survey them, where are they going to hit each other?
You know, it's hard to tell because they are so close, some of them in politics. I mean, I think you're going to see like no names like Cecil Thomas say, well, I'm not in City Hall now. This isn't how I would run my City Hall. Everyone's going to have like these nuances. And I think they're going to talk about their backgrounds a lot. Like where they come from, I think is going to be a big talking point this year, as opposed to like, you know, their actual politics, just because they are similar in that vein. I think you're going to hear Cecil talk about, the Human Relations Commission, the racial equity, and like run kind of on that. You're going to hear Aftab talk about, you know, his experience growing up. And these backgrounds are going to be a story they're trying to tell themselves.
So turnout is probably going to be a pretty significant player because in a primary, it can be challenging to get people to come out to vote. And this is a pretty big field, though. So we're also dealing with this pandemic still. I imagine that's going to play a role.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're looking for like a huge turnout this time. It's just you can kind of judge by past elections on how that goes. People are kind of saying it's not going to be that. And for people to come out and vote in a primary during a pandemic, you need a passion candidate. You need to be like, I love that person so much. And you know who that person was? PG Sittenfeld.
Yeah.
The race. And it'll be interesting to see if any, like, these people have supporters, of course, and they're going to come out and vote for their preferred candidate. But you don't see that fervent love. And like, I mean, look at P.G. Sittenfeld now. He's fighting his corruption charges and 160 people signed a letter and is like, I love P.G. Sittenfeld. And like, that is passion. That's the kind of passion you look for if you're going to have a big turnout and draw these people to vote. And I'm not seeing that at this point.
Sharon Coolidge is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and a good friend of our show. We always appreciate the time you spend with us, Sherry. Thanks for being on with us again. I hope you have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And up next, a local man sues Cincinnati police after he was tased. Officers argue he was ignoring commands. And later, we remember a longtime local broadcaster who died of COVID-19. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. An autistic man is suing the Cincinnati police after he was tased. Officers say this man was ignoring commands. We talk about it now with Inquirer reporter Kevin Grasha, who joins us via Zoom. Kevin, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So the incident we're talking about took place a couple of years ago. So take us back to February of 2019. Tell us who this gentleman is and what happened.
Yeah, his name's Brandon Davis, and he was in his early 30s at the time. He is autistic, and he was walking home from a friend's house at about after 11 o'clock at night in the South Cumminsville area. And he walks near this park, or he says he walked near the park. The police officers think he was in the park after dark, and they want to stop and talk to him, and he won't stop. And the whole thing spins out of control, and he eventually gets tased multiple times, taken to the ground. There's multiple officers that show up. And that's bad enough, but he actually ended up getting charged with several crimes based on the incident, including jaywalking and some other crimes. And he was actually acquitted at trial. And then this year, this month, he filed a lawsuit alleging excessive force and unlawful arrest.
So we're talking about the Wayne Recreation Area. This is a park. He was there apparently after hours. These documents, according to your reporting, place the incident at about 11:17 p.m. Police apparently view this area as a high crime area. You wrote a story this week updating, you know, what the body camera video shows, apparently. Earlier this month, you wrote about this lawsuit as well. This man, Brandon Davis, basically says he was detained by Cincinnati police for being a black man walking at night. What evidence does he provide in his lawsuit to support that claim?
I think that, you know, his attorneys would argue that he really was just walking home, and this apartment building is next to this park. He walks down the driveway of the apartment building and turns on the sidewalk and is just walking home. And he just didn't really understand why they wanted to talk to him, why they wanted to stop him. You know, I don't know how much the autism plays into that. He was just walking home. I mean, that is true. The officers would say you were walking home, but we saw you in the park before. And he does resist them. He won't stop. He won't put his hands behind his back. And there's a lot of things that happen at once that sort of make it spin out of control.
Yeah, this lawsuit does cite Davis's autism as possibly being impacted by the flashing police lights and the loud noises that might come with an arrest. He apparently took out his phone to call his mother for help. But we do have body camera footage from the police officers involved. They claim that he was resisting. So what was the scuffle like? What do we see in the video?
What you see is a man who continues to walk away from police officers who are repeatedly telling him to stop and saying, you know, we're going to tase you. And actually, one of the officers says at one point, I don't want to tase you. But he really will not stop walking away. And then when they do actually, you know, sort of grab hold of him to get him to stop, he won't put his hands behind his back. And you hear the officers say, stop reaching in your pocket, stop reaching in your pocket. And so the officers were obviously there, they were on heightened alert there. And it is an awful situation that was just made worse by, you know, by the fact that he got tased.
It's significant to note that he was reaching in his pocket, apparently to use his phone to call his mother for help, according to the lawsuit, because we have seen incidents like this, particularly involving Black men across the country and encounters with the police, not armed, but believed to have been armed because of similar actions. We do hear some of the conversation on the video between the officers and this gentleman, Brandon Davis. For example, the police officer asks how old he is. He says, I'm 32. And one of the officers says, you know how this game goes, then chill out. You noted that Davis was acquitted at trial, right?
Correct. And he actually has no criminal record, so he really doesn't know how this game goes. You know, they sort of just see this guy. They see an African-American man, and they apparently assume you must have experience interacting with police officers. Or at least that's what the statement appears to be saying. There's something to that.
What does he seek with this lawsuit?
In his statement, he released a statement when the lawsuit was filed, and he said, I think he would like to see the officers not have jobs as police officers again.
What was the response from the police union?
Outrage. The police union president, Dan Hills, vigorously supports these officers and says, you know, they were doing the right thing. And that, you know, what happened because he became physically combative and resisted.
We're talking with Kevin Grasha from the Cincinnati Inquirer. So the lawsuit has been filed. Do we have any indication on when it might proceed into the courts?
These things take years to resolve. There's really no good timeline. But I wouldn't expect anything until next year.
Well, we'll continue to follow. I know you will as well, Kevin. And when there's an update, I hope to have you come back on again. Kevin Grasha with the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And vaccines are on our minds, aren't they? Let's talk about local progress now with another friend from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Ann Saker. Ann, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for inviting me again, Michael.
So we've seen in recent weeks a lot of good news related to vaccines. We saw Johnson & Johnson receive some favorable press just this week with its single-dose vaccine. Yeah. We're seeing expansion of who's eligible for it. But I have to tell you, you know, being what they would call an essential worker in the media, I fall into phase 1C as a Kentucky resident, which they were to open up on March 1. It's really hard to figure out what that means. Like, when can I get online and start to look when I can go get a shot somewhere? And I note that in some of the reporting you've done this week and in recent weeks, one of the keys about this vaccine situation is be patient, right?
Exactly correct, Michael. The federal government decided that they wanted to bring a lot of private providers into the system, instead of sending out vaccine to public health departments who have decades of experience in delivering vaccinations to people. They wanted to bring in all kinds of other private enterprises to do this. And we also have a limited fluctuating supply. So you throw all these extra factors into this mix, and you're just going to have this weird pinched effect at the outset of the rollout. And we felt at the Inquirer that part of our public service in the pandemic was to create some document that would help people get to where they needed to be to sign up for an appointment or to register with a health system to get notified about an appointment. It's not perfect system, but my colleagues, Terry DeMio and our really excellent news intern, Ellen Hine this year, we really kind of put a lot of focus on this. Our editorial leadership really wanted us to have a document that we could, it was a living thing that we could update frequently and help people steer to where they need to be. Part of the problem is that, again, too little supply, big demand. And if you may remember from your Econ 101 class, those things are very difficult to reconcile until they change.
Well, we have never experienced something where like all of us really need to get this in order to achieve that level of herd immunity that would be necessary for us to return to some sense of normalcy. I should note, I'm sure you received this press release too, and somewhere in the news department over at the Inquirer, we got it here at WVXU, and it was from Campbell County and their emergency management office that said, hey, you know, phase 1C in Kentucky means 60 and up and all essential workers. So it's a lot of people now, a lot more than what was previously eligible. And so this press release says, hey, we're doing this vaccine situation at this location in Highland Heights. Less than an hour later, they sent another press release that said, please don't post this. It's full.
Right.
So, well, I mean, the slots are filling fast.
They are. I was just at the only place this week in the 45206 zip code, which is Walnut Hills. The only place that's dispensing vaccine is the Equitas Health Center on Gilbert Street at Peebles Corner. And they had 100 doses this week. Very first time they had been had an allotment to dispense, but only six of the people who got those doses came from that zip code. A lot of people had found out online that this clinic was opening up and had some doses, and so they drove over from Winton Hills and the West Side all over to come and get these, to come and get the doses. So if you're savvy with the internet and you've got the time and energy to spend figuring out where you can get a shot, you get one. But it's really not going to be until perhaps 30 or 60 days from now when we start seeing 100 million doses of vaccine coming into the market, which is going to happen.
And that's really where the patience comes into play, right?
Because
Well, go ahead, Anne. I'm sorry, please.
That's okay. I was just going to say the weather's still kind of dodgy. So I know this has been so hard for us to lock ourselves down and stay locked down until we get this added protection. But remember, when you do get the second vaccination and you let 10 to 14 days go by and you are pretty immune, you still need to wear a mask because there's lots of virus out here still. So until the all clear gets sounded, and who knows when that will be, although that's coming sooner than we thought, maybe even 6 weeks ago. So I think we are moving into spring in many different ways now.
You know, longtime listeners have probably heard and maybe may have even been irritated by my semi-frequent references to my love for Northern Michigan vacations. I know our technical director, Josh Elstro, dislikes it when I reference my love for Traverse City.
Oh, I love it up there. I love it up there.
Well, I'm going somewhere with this, I promise. So I was on vacation just a couple of weeks ago. I went up to Traverse City. Not a great place to visit in the winter unless you're willing to be very, very cold. I describe this current situation we're in with the vaccine as like my drive back from Northern Michigan, right? It's an 8-hour drive and it goes pretty smooth. It goes fast until you hit Dayton. This isn't any shade on Dayton, but you know, it's like that last stretch of the drive and it just seems to take forever. I feel like we're in the Dayton, Ohio phase of the vaccine situation, right? Like you're there and you're like, oh, we're so close to Cincinnati. Why is it taking so long? Is that an apt description?
Well said. Absolutely, Michael. As the end approaches, we become more anxious and more eager to get there. But we still have a lot of hurdles to get over. We're not in the clear yet, but we're getting there. And that's a very exciting prospect right now.
We're talking with Anne Saker from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Anne, you mentioned that we're still going to be wearing masks, and that's something that we are hearing a lot from federal officials. We hear messages from Dr. Fauci, of course, about this. I've also seen some commentary that suggests messages like that could ultimately discourage some people from getting the vaccine. Like if the end's not going to be in sight, if getting the jabs is not going to allow me to go back to where I was, say, in January of 2020, what's the point? Are you hearing any concerns from health officials that type of messaging could deter, or that perhaps the messaging on the vaccine should shift in some capacity?
Both Governor DeWine and Health Commissioner Greg Kesterman in Hamilton County have spoken about these in various briefings lately. The message will change because the situation is changing, and it's it's kind of hard to calibrate it precisely so that everybody hears the same message at the same frequency. But I think that, you know, we're social creatures. We're going to look and see what everybody else needs to be doing right now. And I think one thing we need to be aware of is if we don't follow through all the way with all of the non-pharmaceutical interventions until we don't have to do it anymore, the virus will come back in a big way. And it's going to bring its friends that are known as variants, and they're uglier than the first guy. So we have to be aware that when we say we're through this, we're not done yet. So we have to keep going. There's lots yet to do yet.
It just seems harder to swallow all of this type of information because, you know, we went through such a difficult year and then the vaccines have arrived. And I think we are losing that patience. That is still the key. But with another vaccine set to come online, there might be cause for more optimism, right?
Yes, I think that's just, we're going to see a big bolus of new drug coming into the market, and that's going to help a lot. And especially as warm weather comes, the economy and the government all have motivations to make this happen because we need to start picking up the pace here. And people are, there's pent up demand and there's pent up eagerness to get out and live life again. So, we'll see how they can manage it. It's a big task,
You all produce this guide at the Inquirer. You know, it includes the list of the hospital systems that have vaccines, you know, the health departments, different medical offices, and the pharmacies that are doing this. Is there one path that might be better for certain types of people, or should we just be online looking at all these different providers for when it's our opportunity to get in?
Well, let me first say that if you're not good with being online, it's okay. Not all of us are. Hamilton County has a 211 number that you can call and talk to a real person from United Way who can help you navigate the system. So just let me put that out there first. Secondly, I think if you are connected with a primary care doctor and you've got an electronic medical record, they have been pinging people through your electronic medical record when you are eligible and when there's an appointment available. So if you are facile with that functionality, that I would stay on top of that and then sign up with everybody you can think of and keep an eye on it. But also, you know, relax. You're going to get a shot. Whether it's this week or next week or the week after, in the long run is kind of irrelevant as long as you can keep yourself healthy and masked and socially distant. You'll get there. You're just not going to get it tomorrow. That's all.
We have certainly grown accustomed to wearing our mask, and that's just something we have to remember, is to keep those on and keep our distance and to keep our good hygiene. And right. We will get a shot. I think that's a good message. I've got about a minute left. You have a really cool story, an important story, I should say, not cool, related to the COVID vaccine, and particularly for women who need to time their shot around their mammograms. Very quickly, tell us why that's important.
Certainly. Every vaccine is going to trigger an immune response in you. And one kind of immune response is that sometimes the lymph nodes around the arm or near the arm where you get your injection, sometimes they kind of swell up a little bit because that's your immune system getting ready to set up a defense against a pathogen. And what they have found, it doesn't happen to everybody, but it happens to some people. And often when it happens right before you have a mammogram and the mammogram sees it, an enlarged lymph node can be a warning signal of something else happening in the body. And I've actually had this happen before, and it does leave you feeling freaked out. Oh. Fortunately, my case was completely, it was negative, absolutely negative, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it can mean lymphoma. So, what the Society of Breast Imaging is now telling people is to get your shots either 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks ahead of your mammogram or 4 to 6 weeks afterward to minimize the possibility that you get this lymph node response after a vaccination.
Ann Saker is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Read her coverage at cincinnati.com. Ann, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. I hope you have a great weekend.
Same to you. Thank you so much. Take care.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined now via Zoom by WVXU media beat writer John Keysweater. John, thanks for coming back on.
Hey, thanks, man. Thanks for the invitation.
So when I think about the lyrics to the famous theme song to WKRP in Cincinnati, making my way up and down the dial, living on the air in Cincinnati, I wonder if any real person better encapsulated that than Pat Barry, who we lost last week.
That's a real good point. And in fact, when WKRP was on a channel called Antenna TV, he actually did some promos from Cincinnati for it. But yeah, I mean, he worked for about 10 stations, 10 radio stations, Channel 5 and Channel 19. Plus, he would do the opening day parade coverage on Fox Sports Ohio. So, I mean, he was all over the dial.
I mean, he was a big, boisterous personality, very unique. He maintained that classic old school radio style that was probably more popular in the 70s or 80s. I had the pleasure of working with him at three different locations as I made my own way up and down the dial in the local market at Clear Channel, at Channel 19. I produced the weekend news where he was the weather guy. And then just before I came here, I was working with him at Grant County Broadcasters on WNKR and WNKN, where he was doing air shifts and doing sales, and that's where I got to know him the best. Man, he had some stories.
True. And the other thing about Pat is, yeah, he was up and down the dial, but he did country. That really surprised me near the end of his career. He did oldies, of course. He did. He was part of the Q102 when it was really hot back in the 70s and 80s. He also did some talk on KRC and LW. He used to fill in for Jim Scott on WLW. And the other thing, you mentioned the big, boisterous personality. Jerry Springer, when he became anchor in 84, and a new general manager came into Channel 5, they were talking about what they could do with the newscast. And Springer said, he suggested, we ought to get somebody like Willard Scott, who was really big on the Today Show, probably the most popular national weatherman, but he wasn't a meteorologist. They said, you know, there's this big, boisterous personality over at Q102, Pat Barry. We ought to bring him in for an audition. And so Jerry met Pat at a bar one night and suggested it. And apparently Pat's first reaction was, no, I know nothing about weather. And Jerry said, no, you know everybody. You got a great personality. You're larger than life. You'll rock. And it worked. He joined Jerry Springer and Norma Rashid in 1984. And by 1987, and thanks to the must-see TV lineup of NBC, Channel 5 was number one in the news.
You know, by the time I got to work with him at Channel 19, it was really out of fashion for non-meteorologists to be doing the weather on television. TV stations wanted to promote that they have these certified meteorologists, people who study the science behind forecasting. But Channel 19 kept him, and he was really good at it.
And very popular, very beloved. But interestingly, you know, Channel 5 had a meteorologist from day one and Tony Sands going back to the 50s. And they benched Tony Sands to bring in Pat Barry. After they hit number one, they actually replaced him with their meteorologist and let him go. And then they brought in another meteorologist that didn't work. And then they came back and brought back Pat in 90 or 91. And he did another 2, 3, 4 years before he later worked at 19.
And you noted that it surprised you that he ended up at a country music station. That's where he was most recently with Grant County Broadcasters, which does the classic country format on WNKR and WNKN. And I was the morning news guy there. He went right into that seamlessly. So you could hear him doing, you know, immediately prior to that, doing the old school oldies on WDJO. And he transitioned right into country music with no problem at all. That's the kind of talent he was.
And the other thing about Pat is he seemed to know everybody in town. And when stars would come through between his friendships with Chris Collinsworth or Johnny Bench or Dennis Jansen or so many others, or Jim Fox at Q102, I mean, he was seen with everybody. There's, on his Facebook feed, there's pictures of him with Rodney Dangerfield, Monty Hall, just all kinds of stuff.
He used to get Rodney Dangerfield comparisons, right? He had sort of a similar tone in his voice.
And he had this wonderful self-deprecating sense of humor. He would always tell me, you know, I started in Springfield at a really big station. It had 12 pumps.
We'll take it. We'll allow it. Yeah, he was very funny and always ready to be roasted himself and could roast us on a whim. And I'd get stuck at the station down in Grant County with him for hours trying to leave, but he would have great stories and I'd be riveted. And you saw all the tributes come in. I mean, everyone in town seemed to know him.
Exactly. And he, you know, when he was in the room, he was the loudest voice and generally the magnet or the yellow lamp that everybody kind of orbited around. It just, you wanted to hear what he had to say. And Carol Williams, I think, said it well, too. Says, when you were with him, he made you feel like you were special and he was entertaining you and cared about you, which he did. But also you left feeling a lot better about yourself and a lot happier. And that's just a wonderful gift to have.
He will definitely be missed. There's another longtime local broadcast veteran who's struggling with COVID-19, I understand.
Exactly. Michael Flannery, who was a local comedian. He was Michael from the Fox 19 Kids Club, then later was a reporter for Channel 9, and now the spokesman for Goodwill. Actually, on last Saturday, when Pat Barry died, he put up a video on Facebook saying he was in the COVID ward at Good Sam and he got COVID. He was caring for his wife and daughter who had COVID, and he didn't wear a mask. And he said, please wear a mask, wash your hands, keep your distance. It hurts to breathe. Since then, he's been put on the ventilator. But just about an hour ago, I checked the website. And they said that they're putting him on a drug that the next 2 days will ease the sedative that he's on. And they're hoping that in the next 2 or 3 days, and they might be able to see if they can wean him off the vent.
My goodness. I mean, these are just such significant reminders that while there is the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel of this pandemic, it's still here and you could still catch it. And Pat Barry was 69 years old, so sort of in that vulnerable age range, but not really. And Michael Flannery is even younger than that. So it's still very dangerous.
You know, I covered a lot of the great broadcasters, and I've unfortunately written a lot of their obits. And just in the past couple of months, you know, I wrote about Captain Wendy, Wanda Lewis from the Uncle Al show. I wrote about several others, but Pat hit home because, you know, he's just a year away from me. And, you know, it was one of us, just like when Jim Fox passed a year ago, that I'm now part of the generation of the talent of the broadcasters that have started to pass. And so Pat Barry really hit home close.
Well, we will end on a good note that you've got another year around the sun. Today's your birthday, Keese. We want to wish you a very happy birthday.
Thank you very much. And thanks to the at least one donor during the fund drive who donated in my honor.
Well, I don't have to tell you how popular your media columns are at WVXU.org. So you have become a very important part of this operation. So thanks to you. Thanks for sharing some stories with us today. And I hope you make it a great birthday as best you can.
I want to get out on a bicycle because it gets a little warmer.
Good. I hope that happens for you. All right, John, we'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Talk again on Monday.